Support for this episode of Talking Machines comes from Stitcher Premium. Stitcher Premium gets you completely ad-free episodes of hundreds of shows like Comedy Bang Bang, WTF with Marc Maron, and How Did This Get Made? You also get 2,100 hours of exclusive content. New exclusive originals like Marvel's Wolverine and Issa Rae's Fruit are launching every week for Stitcher Premium members. When you listen to ad-free episodes in Stitcher Premium, your favorite podcasters get paid. Help support your favorite shows and join Stitcher Premium today. For one free month of listening, go to stitcherpremium.com and use the promo code MACHINES. That's stitcherpremium.com, promo code MACHINES. You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman, and this week finds us at ICML, the International Conference on Machine Learning. So we're going to bring you a little bit of a shortened episode. Today, we're going to hear from Jennifer Dee, who is a professor at Northeastern in Boston, and she's also the program chair, one of two program chairs with Andreas Krauss, of this year's ICML. And when we got to sit down with her, I asked her the first question we ask all of our guests. How did you get where you are?
I grew up in the Philippines, so I had my undergrad there. And then I wanted to learn more, so I went to the U.S. to do grad school. I went to Purdue University.
Fantastic.
Yeah. for my master's and for my PhD. So I actually had an undergrad in electrical engineering.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then I was interested in image processing. Mm-hmm. So I did a master's in image processing. And then for my PhD, I work with Carla Broadley, who introduced me to machine learning.
Nice.
So I like machine learning because I like the understanding part of working with data. So I started with images and because I like images, and then I like the understanding piece of how to make them useful and also to automatically detect what's out there. That's why it led me to machine learning. And then after PhD, I enjoy teaching. And so I went directly from grad school and then got a university position in Northeastern.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so I went the direct path.
So, and you lead a group at Northeastern.
Yes.
Tell me about what questions you're asking, what you guys are working on.
So one thing I do is that I do both fundamental research in machine learning and also applications of machine learning to health, science, and engineering. Mm-hmm. What led me to machine learning was really I like working with how to make it useful to society. And even for PhD, actually, I was attracted to projects in medical imaging. So similarly, once I started my PhD program, I started looking for collaborations and working with applications that also has usefulness to health. Luckily, I have collaborations with Brigham and Women's Hospital. Mm-hmm. And there we looked at lung disease called COPD.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease of the lungs, which is usually affected due to smoking or pollution. And so I work with that group to try and discover what you call disease subtypes. So right now they classify things into one disease called COPD, but they know it's heterogeneous, so they want to figure out
what are the subgroups.
What are the subgroups?
Big catch-all for being able not to breathe real good.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And so that we can help better prognosis and personalized treatment of patients. And the cool thing about that is it matches with what I've been working on in machine learning, which is clustering. So when you do subtyping, basically you just have a bunch of data, and the goal is really how do you cluster them automatically so that we can stratify the patients and have better attention to different subgroups.
So essentially you're going through all of the state data that you have, and if you cluster into a certain group, you can essentially call that a substratification of the disease, and maybe these patients would benefit from similar treatment?
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah. It's a long process to actually get there, but yeah, hopefully that's what we would like to do.
Tell me a little bit more about this project. Are the images you're using X-rays?
They're computed tomography images, so HRCT.
Nice.
And it's 3D images. We also collect genetic data.
Oh, wow.
And clinical data. It's a consortium from 21 clinical sites around the U.S.
So
it's huge. So Brigham and Women's is part of that, so I'm lucky to have collaborations with them, but it also involves other hospitals.
That's amazing. It's such an incredible project. And I feel like there's been such a influx of medical applications because there's so much information. And if you can just say something that's a little bit more specific about what that information could mean to a patient's treatment, it could be such a huge impact. Yeah. How have you seen this project evolve?
The cool thing is, I mean, in any multidisciplinary research, it takes a while. You actually have to work together.
Get another PhD, kind of.
And collaborate. And you have to understand each other's language. And we also have different models of publication. So you have to be understanding about it and you help each other. So it took a while, but it's great. It's great because we can make impact to how we understand the disease better.
Yeah.
So I tend to work with multidisciplinary research because it allows all the different disciplines to improve and grow. And the cool thing about working with real data is that it challenges state of the art in machine learning.
Yeah, so, definitely. Right. If you're not using a toy data set, you have something actually to try to break. Yeah.
So initially, I mean, when they came to us, they thought, well, you can just use machine learning to make this work. But then,
Can you machine learn this?
And then we have to talk to them and then make them realize that machine learning is not just a magic tool where you get results immediately, that when you do clustering, you actually have assumptions. So in clustering, the goal is to group together similar objects into the same group. And then when you do that, you have to define what you call a similarity. And then you have to define the metric and you have to, or a probability model. So you have to explain to them what it means. That it has some assumptions. So if I just apply, let's say, k-means, you assume they're compact clusters and spherical, and then you all the features have equal weights, but maybe that's not what you mean. You want them to have different weights with like a Gaussian assumption, for example, and you have to explain that. And then we realized that's not what they were looking for in the end. So it takes a while. So you have to consider that and think about modeling the actual problem. That's the piece I like. So once you get there, once you go through that barrier, you now start thinking about, okay, so now that means standard toolbox don't work. So now we have to come up with the proper model, and then it then leads to more innovative algorithms.
So tell me, so you've worked in lots of interdisciplinary projects. Tell me about that translational leap where you're trying to sort of teach these other researchers the things that they can actually do with machine learning and get them beyond the point of just, can you machine learning this for me? What's the biggest challenge that you've had there in trying to translate or create that connection across a discipline?
The greatest challenge is really understanding the problem. Because when they talk to us, they have their own language, and then I usually collaborate with academics, so they usually start going to like the technical language of their field. So I collaborate, by the way, also with climate and also psychologists. They can get into their own language, and then that's the barrier we had to overcome. And then we have to explain also what we mean with different models and different algorithms. And usually, too, they're not used to like the math and the equations.
Yeah.
And we're used to showing the equations. So it takes a while to describe. And usually we have to show them a lot of visualizations too. And actually that leads me to the later piece of my work, where now after we build these complex models to help them learn, we realize that, you can show that it works well and has great accuracy, but for them to really trust it.
Yeah. Because they're an expert in this and they're like, I don't know why that's saying that.
Exactly. So it led us to start looking more into models that are also interpretable so that they can understand what's going on.
Yeah. Tell me more about the work in interpretability.
It's not easy because really when you build models, you want to push for accuracy and prediction ability of your model. But then when you go to interpretability, sometimes you have that kind of trade-off because now you have to make it more simple so that they can understand. In the context of our work, so we've been working with like clustering models. Even let's say like a Gaussian mixture is complicated for them because they want to know what the boundaries were and so on.
Yeah.
And with doctors, they actually like to know if it's greater than or less than some features. It's easier for them to do that. So we started looking into, let's say, rule-based types or like a rectangular rules type of boundaries. So the box just defined the boundaries, right. And then it gives us a latent variable model of what belongs to inside the box or not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then you can make it more complex where inside the box defines some cluster preserving property, which they care about.
That's fantastic. It seems like it's a good fungible concept that you could move easily between disciplines, right? Like here's the box, here are the latent things in this box, right? Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it would be an easy idea to carry from project to project.
That makes it easy. And the other thing too is they also want to know like which features are important. Mm-hmm. So it also led us to work with feature selection and make it understandable to them.
Tell me more about the project on climate.
So we have a new professor, I mean, not new anymore, who moved to Northeastern.
The and most then, recent one.
Yes. So this is Arup Ganguly. When he joined Northeastern, he started collaborating with me and then I got involved in that. So in this project, we were interested in the problem called downscaling. And really what it means is that you have climate variable models that are coarser scale. So it's like kilometer by kilometer wide scale. And they have like prediction models for this. And the problem is we want it to be at a finer resolution scale to use it for planning and
preparedness
and so on.
Yeah.
So basically it's a super resolution type of problem. If you relate it to image processing,
right.
From coarse resolution to high resolution. Yeah. So he was interested in that, and that's what we started working on. And then we started looking at, again, with climate, it's spatiotemporal, so it's a different kind of data. So now we have to start looking at
the fundamental questions.
Those
there.
Kind of models, exactly.
So you're also working on a project about cancer. Tell me how that project got started.
So that got started because, again, starting with a collaborator who came to me, and he's actually an optical engineer called Malin Rajashka.
Nice.
And he works at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. He builds a machine called confocal microscopy, and it allows you to visualize under the skin.
Oh, wow.
So the cool thing about this is that instead of doing a biopsy,
right.
We can just use this confocal microscope to see under the skin and hopefully help us diagnose cancer.
That's
skin
incredible.
Cancer or not. So the challenging thing is that the images are actually poor resolution and poor contrast. So we have to then come up with innovative machine learning and image processing to help make sense out of that data.
That's amazing. And such an amazing tool to help further a non-invasive process for so many patients.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's why when I got involved in this, I got excited about it because we can hopefully make that happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you find that you can apply the same thinking from the climate project when you're trying to move from coarse resolution to fine resolution when you have simply a different kind of image? It may also have like different parameters if you're trying to clarify the image in addition to going from a low resolution to a high resolution. But does that thinking, are there similarities there? Can you use similar approaches?
It's actually, although they're both images, the data is very different, and the challenges are very different.
Yeah.
So in the skin imaging problem, it's poor resolution, but they have structure behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, we started thinking about models that we can take advantage of the structure we know that we're looking for.
Got it.
So in particular, they're looking for like hills and valley, which is which is like a shape structure behind this three-dimensional image, and then we incorporate that into our model to try to find this latent structure hidden in this 3D image. With climate, it's a little bit different because it's not
less structured.
It's not structured.
Yeah.
So the challenges and the tricks that you use are a little bit different. But actually, we can use some of the other things, like in the lung project.
Mm-hmm.
There are some similarities in that we can figure out some structure.
Highly structured three-dimensional data, or at least structured to the point where you sort of know what you're looking
What you're looking for. Maybe there is some connection in the sense of how do you start thinking about combining physics models with with data.
Yeah.
Or in general, like domain or scientific type of models, mm-hmm. that you know about the problem, and combining it with data.
Yeah.
And I think that's also another interesting challenge for machine learning, to how do you actually incorporate both at the same time.
Yeah, bring the tools into the physical world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And also domain expertise knowledge, how do you incorporate that into machine learning models? Because usually when you work with real problems and with collaborators, you soon realize that they know a lot.
Yeah.
And it will be great to be able to incorporate that knowledge.
It basically allows you to lift the structure, right? Like, yes. But you have to be able to talk to the person in the language that they can understand, so they can uncover that structure for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Uncover it, and then you figure out how to use that into your models.
So. Yeah, definitely. And tell me more about the basic research that you're doing, the foundational research that you're doing in your lab.
So I do a lot of work on clustering, dimensionality reduction, and feature selection.
Nice.
And usually I build models with latent variable. I like probability models because you can easily incorporate your assumptions and modeling behind these algorithms. I work on those, and then I started expanding also. So again, the full scope of machine learning, semi-supervised, supervised. And recently I also started looking into active learning. So usually in supervised learning, right, you collect data and then put labels on it. But when you want them to be labeled, especially the ones I work with are usually experts like doctors and very expensive.
Yeah. You can't ask them to sit for hours and click through labeling stuff.
Yeah. So exactly. So that led us to start thinking about active learning. So in active learning, it finds an efficient way to mm-hmm. actually select samples more intelligently, so that you don't have to label too many samples.
Right. Yeah. Expanding your data set in a sort of a cheap way.
In a cheaper way. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. It's still not cheap, but.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's still not cheap, but like relatively.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. That's, yeah. So I don't know. So I started working into that as well. And then the other thing that I worked on is we have experts.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have not just one, but many experts.
Yeah.
So we thought of starting also, like, why don't we ask them?
Yeah.
But they have multiple different varying opinions and varying levels of
expertise. Disagree with each other. Yes, right. Yeah.
So we have to build models where actually, how do you combine inputs from multiple annotators?
Yeah.
And also learn their uncertainty.
The work that you've done mm-hmm. is so fundamental and has like so many application areas. Mm-hmm. And people are bringing you lots of varied questions. You have lots of spaces you can explore and play in. But then you often have to like find a new way to approach these questions because the experts don't really know what they're asking of you.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's a lot to be done. There's lots of opportunity, but a lot to be done.
Yeah, there's a lot to be done. So. Yeah, exactly. So usually that's what happens. So they come to me and then I start looking into the problem. And then in the end, we realize, well, you know, we do have to come up with innovative machine learning for this. And then it led us to some interesting problem. And then we go deeper and then led to PhD thesis.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And your chair, your program chair mm-hmm. of ICML this year, congratulations.
Thank you.
So what are you excited about this year?
So it's exciting. It's an honor to be a program chair. It's quite exciting because of the growth.
Yeah.
So this year we have approximately 2,500 submissions.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Talk about a reviewing headache.
Oh, well, luckily we have so many reviewers and area chairs, which actually made it easier.
Fantastic.
So, and we try to make their review load low too, but mm-hmm. so that they can have quality reviews.
Right.
So, but the good thing is I mean, Andres and I were pretty happy with the review process. We've got good quality papers this year.
Great.
And you'll have to find out.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it goes.
We'll see, yeah. Well, of course, there's still a lot of, like, there's a lot of deep learning papers mm-hmm. going on. Mm-hmm. And there's also a lot of work on fairness this yeah. year, too. So, yeah. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
It should be really interesting.
It should be very interesting, yeah.
Jennifer D. That's it for us this week on Talking Machines. Tune in next episode.